KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. At the time that I'm recording this show on June 6th, by the time you hear this show, I will have transitioned into a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society and an assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I continue my affiliation with CIS as well as continuing to do Hearsay Culture on KZSU and through its podcast venues. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of a book called Virtual Realities and Their Discontents. And when I say author, I should say an edited volume. And I have the editor as well as an author of one of the essays in the book on the show today. Virtual Realities and Their Discontents is a book that actually goes back much further than most of the books, perhaps even all of the books whose authors I've interviewed on Hearsay Culture. It goes back to the prehistoric times of 1996. And in Virtual Realities and Their Discontents, Professor Bob Markley, from the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, has edited a book that focuses on kind of the the build-up to the dot-com boom and taking a look at a lot of the claims with regard to how the Internet would change the world and where the Internet would go and how this virtual reality, as was defined in the book, really would change the way that people interact with technology and with information. And the book takes a skeptical view of a lot of the pronouncements, which were admittedly quite flowery and often quite utopian in 1996. And in particular, in Bob's essay himself, he takes a look at some of the comparisons between what was known as the information superhighway, and still is in a lot of ways, and those flowery proclamations. In Bob's essay as well, he takes a look at some of the logical constructs that go through the world of technology. But what we're going to do today in chatting with Bob is kind of take a look back at this book and some of the conclusions that were reached and kind of take a look forward to see how things have played out a bit. But I'm very excited to have Bob Markley, who's professor of English and a Romano professorial scholar at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. So we're going to do a short music break now, and when we come back, we're going to take a look back and discuss the book Virtual Realities and Their Discontents, a book which, despite being over 10 years old, I think is still very relevant today. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. Professor Bob Markley. Bob, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you for having me.
I also want to thank you, and I will acknowledge this, that I want to thank you for your flexibility as we schedule this interview and went through various logistical and engineering rigmaroles. So I especially thank you for joining me today on the show. Let's start with really your background, because on Hearsay Culture, I generally have had people that are technologists and that focus heavily in the field. Your background as a professor of English, and particularly focusing on British history, is unusual for the show. So perhaps we can start off by discussing a little bit more of your background and how you came to edit a volume like this.
I kind of wondered that myself sometimes. Well, I was trained in a rather traditional way as a literary historian of 17th and 18th century culture, but relatively quickly I got interested in the so-called scientific revolution of the 17th and 18th centuries, and indeed my second book was on Isaac Newton and Robert Boyle. And from that I developed into a kind of nomadic scholar who looks at the relationships between the humanities and sciences more broadly. And as somebody who typed his dissertation on a typewriter, which I used to scare my graduate students, I actually lived through at a relatively advanced age the technological revolution. So as I sit here many years later and hold my entire music library on my iPod mini, I have to reflect, and I think we all have to reflect critically on where we've been and where we've come over the last few decades in terms of technology and in terms of the claims that technology has made on us as citizens, in my case as humanists, but as people who deal with these, on the one hand, enormous changes, and on the other hand, the ways in which these enormous changes in technology have not really changed things all that much in some other ways.
I've been very fortunate on the show to have a number of guests on who are English professors, and so I had the pleasure of interviewing Richard Latham on his book, The Economics of Attention, and I even had on, someone who will be heard this summer, but Larry Downs is a professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley who has thought about the comparisons between what we now call the technological revolution and the industrial revolution of the 19th century. And I guess as an English professor coming into this, how does your background in that discipline in looking at the language of our culture and indeed in the historical perspective that you bring to it, how does that impact your view generally of technology?
Well, I think the advantage that anybody who's trained in literature has when looking at culture more broadly is we're trained not to believe anything in the sense that everything is fiction or everything is potentially fiction. And so we tend to look at how things are put together rather than in rather narrow sense their truth value. So I know that Shakespeare's Hamlet, for example, is not an accurate rendition of a medieval Danish prince, but I don't expect it to be. And so when I'm evaluating technology, I'm trying to see how it works, how it is put together in a broad cultural context as well as individually. So I think that in general, I have a certain kind of healthy skepticism that's part of my training about claims that people make. And this is certainly helpful in dealing with distinguishing between advertising and analysis when it comes to the technological revolution. And so I think that one reason you've probably had a lot of people on who've trained in literature is that we really never have the answers in the back of the books as my science textbooks did, and we have to figure things out on some level. And in some cases, I'll be perfectly frank, make things up. So we're always negotiating between that objectivity and that subjective biases as well. So I think that to a certain extent it's relatively easy for me to look at the kind of rhetorical or semiotic claims that are being made about technology and to have a certain skepticism about them, but also a certain skepticism about that skepticism, if your listeners can follow that.
I think I can follow the iterations there, because and it's true, and I think this kind of brings us into kind of taking a look back to 1996 as we enter the Wayback Machine that Brewster Kahle's made so famous. But, you know, 1996 clearly was a time where, you know, the phrase information superhighway, I think, sums it up nicely. There was definitely a utopian, Mumford-type perspective with respect to what technology could do. Now, you know, we can talk in a little more detail about how much technology really has changed things, putting things as a very broad term. But I guess to start off the discussion, perhaps you could give us a window into your view of technology generally in 1996 when you came about doing this book.
Well, in 1996, or actually the essay really dates from a year or two earlier, in 1994, the first version of the essay.
Fair enough.
I was a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I ended up through a series of circumstances as an observer slash anthropologist at the Human Interface Technology Lab, the HIT Lab, at the University of Washington, which was one of the big, and I guess still is, virtual reality labs in the country. So I was watching the process of programmers sitting there with effectively mainframes trying to construct virtual worlds, which in by our standards look pretty cartoonish in retrospect. And I was being asked by some of my students who were also doing kind of field work down there what the relationship is between virtual reality, which was then being touted as the next great thing, and what the engineers in the lab called real reality, which we're all stuck in. And so I think at that time there was a real heady optimism about what virtual reality could do. There were estimates that there was a multi-billion dollar industry waiting to happen when we would retrofit all, you know, Pac-Man and Donkey Kong as virtual reality games. And I really think that there were probably people who expected by 2007 we'd be pretty well on our way to the holodeck. Now, that hasn't happened, and I think part of the reason that hasn't happened has to do with the technological problems in dealing with these vast amounts of information, and also has to do with the kind of nature of the assumptions that we make very generally about technology. And so I think that, 1996 was kind of an very interesting moment for myself and my contributors to assess the nature of the claims. While we were writing the book, the web came into existence. And I can remember actually listening to Tom Brokaw on a newscast ask somebody, as I was sitting at my computer writing, on the news, what Google was and what Yahoo meant, because these were brand new terms. So in that sense, when the web is seemingly ubiquitous, it does seem like, you know, it's a bare step above, building the pyramids or, some technological marvel of that era.
When we, you alluded to a point that I think is important in connection with putting together where we are with this book today. And you mentioned, and accurately, I think, that virtual reality has a very different meaning today than it did in 1994, 95, 96. Perhaps for the benefit of our listeners, what did you mean by virtual reality in the book, and what do you mean by virtual reality in this volume?
Great question. I think then if we use the term virtual reality singular, what we meant was these devices, elaborate rigs that we stood in with helmets and earphones and all sorts of force feedback mechanisms, and existed in virtual worlds. So as opposed to moving through a world, the world in effect moved around you. And this required elaborate computing and engineering feats for 1994, 1995, 1996. And I think that in that sense, we were all thinking about people with these headsets on, earphones, all sorts of mechanisms, and you would actually experience in some way being in a very, radically different environment than you were in physically. I think more generally, virtual realities, plural, as we use it in the title, suggested the wide range of digital cultures which were then exploding. And I think that one reason that we were attracted to the notion of virtual realities is the idea that technology was not simply visual or not simply auditory, that, in a sense, virtual realities recreated a kind of techno environment around us. So all the contributors to the volume, I think, were in different ways concerned with the larger ecological, in the broad sense, relationships of technology to individual subjects. And so that's really what we meant in 96. I think that one of the things that we've come to recognize with the gadgets and handheld devices and upgraded laptops that we now take for granted is that we really are in some measure living in an environment that has been reshaped by these technological devices.
And that, that issue, I think, is, still being debated today when we take a look at issues, ranging from the posting of content on YouTube and whether that content has value, however we define it, to whether print journalism will exist can coexist with the abundance of blogs. It goes right down the list. And I think what we're looking at here, and I guess really my next question for you is, before we get to that, maybe the better follow-up question here is for the benefit of listeners who haven't read your essay, and I'm not asking you and won't in this interview to summarize every author's piece in the work. We're going to focus on your essay in particular, but perhaps your core theme or thesis that you were trying to advance with respect to how we view technology would be helpful.
Sure. I think that basically my concern was precisely with the kind of utopian claims that virtual realities would radically change the relationship between you or me as individual subjects and our environments, and that the virtual reality would put you or put me or put any user in the position of controlling the environment. So there was, in many respects, not only a utopian aspect to this construction of virtual reality, but also a kind of idea that we were moving to some new evolutionary level where humans would be able to exercise a great deal of control over these virtual environments, and that therefore we as individual subjects would change. We would become different kinds of human beings, frankly, on a psychological level and indeed on an embodied physical level as well. So I was concerned with those discourses, those ideas floating around. And what I did in the essay was actually look at the mathematical theories that undergirded virtual reality, particularly the work of William Bricken, which is very interesting philosophical stuff, very esoteric. I had to sort of train myself to learn this kind of strange mathematical language, which was predicated on Spencer Brown's laws of form, if any of your listeners are familiar with that. And then what I tried to do is unpack the implications of this and insisted in my, you know, skeptical English professory kind of way that we all remain very much so embodied subjects with particular points of view and particular subjectivities, and simply surrounding us with different kinds of technologies will change us, but it's not a kind of revolutionary change that can be mapped onto some utopian evolutionary progression.
It's certainly, I think, at least among many of the listeners to this show, point worthy of dispute and of discussion. And so I'm going to push back on that a little bit to kind of probe your thoughts here. But before we do that, I do want to ask you, I don't want to get too abstract, but a question about utopian theory and its usefulness. When, you know, when we think about the writers like Mumford and others who have focused on what the perfect city would look like, or how a city or town should be constructed so as to encourage this form of government that would be completely democratic in the small d sense, and where people would be happy and free and et cetera and so forth. Even, you know, in his day, Mumford was derided as being too flowery and not quite realistic. And clearly, the utopian city like Atlantis really hasn't come to fruition, at least in any meaningful way in the world, although there have been some efforts. I guess it leads me to this question. Given your skepticism, do you see that the utopian, using that phrase loosely, but the proclamations of the technologists of the early and mid-90s whose comments, met with your skepticism, had any value? In other words, I guess the broad question is, does utopian theory from the perspective of technology have any value, or does it serve any useful purpose in your view?
I think it does serve a useful purpose, and I think that what utopian, particularly utopian literature, often does is give us a way to imagine ourselves out of our environment, to make our current environment, our current political conditions, our current technologies seem strange, seem not the natural course of things. And so I think, for me, the value of utopian literature or utopian perspectives, and scholars such as Frederick Jameson have made this point, is a way to think about alternatives to the way that things are now. Certainly, I think one of the things also that one needs to be aware of is that the utopian philosophies of a generation ago, in very interesting ways, shape our perceptions of realities today, although it's not a one-to-one mapping of particular views. I think you can see this particularly in something like science fiction, where in some respects one looks at the design of, say, the iPod. There's nothing that, says an iPod should look like that. I hope I'm not giving Steve Jobs, FCC plug here that's going to get me in trouble. But you look at an iPod and it looks suspiciously like, the tricorders on communication devices on Star Trek, the old TV show from the 60s. And in a way, our conceptions of what a technological future are going to look like are, in a sense, always shaped by previous assumptions and values, many of which we take for granted, about what the future will be like. So I think utopianism is always valuable in that respect, and it's often a very hard thing to distinguish between what actually we foresee happening and what, in a sense, we've been expecting to see happen in the future. So I suspect as MP3 players and iPods get smaller and smaller, there are engineers and technologists who have William Gibson's trilogy in mind from the 1980s, where we, have plugins behind our ears that, load the software directly to our brains.
A lot of what you discuss in the book focuses on identity, and we're going to take a short music break in a few minutes, but perhaps I will do the dangerous thing of reading a quote from your essay and then maybe getting your reaction to it in light of where we are today. You say on page 74 of the volume, and again, of course, one should read the entire essay to get the full context, so it's a wildly unfair question I'm about to ask. But such is life. You say, in this respect, cyberspace must destabilize liberal humanist conceptions of identity in favor of postmodern fragmented and performative subjectivities to market itself as a means to transform this always unstable and always incomplete identity into a thoroughly efficient, desiring machine. Now, that's saying a lot, and I guess I'd ask you before we go into the music break, how, in retrospect, do you think that that statement still holds true?
Well, it sounds very 1990s to me. I feel like getting out a pair of, bell bottoms from the 70s to answer that question. I think, though, that my general point probably holds true.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you're being marketed a device or a technology that's going to make you more complete, that's going to increase your enjoyment of life, that is going to transform your existence in ways that you haven't thought possible, in retrospect, what that means is that your current mode of existence is somehow lacking. It needs something. It's not that you want the technology that's coming down the line. You absolutely need this technology to make you really a human, a human being. So I think I would probably tweak what I'd say to emphasize what I said back then, at least, to emphasize the consumerist aspect of any kind of vision of the technological future. And I mean, the danger, of course, that we all experience is that if we don't have a new iPod or MP3 player, if we don't upgrade our computer, we're somehow going to be left behind. And if a student at Stanford or another university has a laptop from 1992 that doesn't hook up to the internet, that student is, in a sense, not only economically perhaps underprivileged, but is made to feel inadequate in one way, shape, or form, completely out of the loop. So I think that my general point holds true, that our conceptions of ourselves as citizens, as subjects, has this component of the technological real, as Michelle Kendrick calls it in an essay in the volume I edited, that we can't really separate ourselves out from a technological revolution. And technological revolution is reshaping us, at the same time provoking that kind of consumer desire always to allow ourselves to be reshaped.
The consumer desire issue and how our identity is impacted by it, I think, is a topic that I want to take up after the music break, because a lot of your essay focuses on concepts of alienation and identity on the internet, which obviously ties into your definition of virtual realities as you articulated at the beginning of the interview. So we're going to take a short music break here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture, and then after the music break, return with a discussion with Professor Bob Markley of the University of Illinois. Before we return to the conversation with Professor Bob Markley, now's the time on Hearsay Culture where I ask you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its broad range of programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, or indeed if you'd like to learn more about donating to KZSU, please email
email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. So we're back with Bob Markley. And Bob, before the break, I was getting into a little bit of alienation, and I think as a segue into that topic, I do want to touch more on these cliches from 1996. You know, information superhighway and phrases like information wants to be free were in vogue at that time, and we know now that information very much does not want to be free and can easily be regulated. And I think what we see today, and I kind of want to get your reaction to it, is kind of a change in some of the views with respect to these very flowery proclamations. You see wikis, blogs, podcasts, and things like that. Does the social media aspect of the internet, which didn't exist in 1996, but does exist today in 2007, change how you view the theorists and the people talking about the impact of the internet?
Great question. I mean, I think that, if I were to redo a collection of essays on that topic again, or on the topic of digital culture more generally, we would be talking in a way about different kinds of utopian pronouncements about what's going to happen in the future. I think that we now know that information is not going to be free. I think we also know, in a sense, that the transformations that we are undergoing as a society plug very neatly into certain kind of models of how we behave as citizens, how we behave economically, in ways that were hard to predict in the mid-1990s. The example I would give is, voting for American Idol, mm-hmm. or, the nightly poll on ESPN where they ask a question and you can answer yes or no on the website, and then there are bar graphs that come up, and you can figure out how many people in Idaho, or what percentage of people in Idaho, think that Barry Bonds used steroids. And I think that has that has changed, and so that we recognize that, and I think this is a good thing, that what we were saying about information and about digital culture has become much more complex. Another way of thinking mm-hmm. about this is, we thought, or many people thought, about the utopian political possibilities of digital culture. And, if we had said in 2007 there'll be, electronic voting and touchscreen voting and, anybody will be able to post his or her political views on a blog, a word that didn't exist at the time, I think many people would have taken those as wonderful advances in democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, instead, of course, now there are many of us who want paper ballots so that we can actually right. check and make sure those touchscreens work. And, the so-called blogosphere, as I think we all recognize, is a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mixed bag in a very complicated kind of way. There's some great things out there, and there are a lot of people who are, telling us what they had for dinner and complaining about, potholes not being fixed on their streets thousands of miles away from us.
The aspect of the internet which I think gets a lot of people riled up is the question of quality. And it's such a subjective term that I hesitate to get into a detailed discussion of it. But I guess, to get your reaction to it, having looked at this with the skeptical eye going back to the early 90s, there are people that come out and say, well, there's only a couple of things on YouTube. In fact, Andrew Keen, who has a new book out, again, being recorded in early June, but has a book called The Cult of the Amateur, has said that there's only a couple of things on YouTube that are worth reading or a couple of blogs that are worth reading. And I guess it boils down to this kind of question. Does the medium itself, that is the internet and the distribution network that exists on the internet, by way of the internet, itself, is it, can you view it as a social good, and the content that we choose to put on it by virtue of being users of the internet as a separate identity. In other words, to clarify this question, which I've kind of rambled on, does the internet itself as a medium of communication itself, in your view, suggest that the way the human beings use it is the real issue? Or is the very technology itself, to you, subject to some dispute?
Well, that's a great question. It's tough to answer because I think what we're talking about here are emerging forms of media and emerging forms of individual responses and social responses to media. My guess is that I think the direction in which we're heading now is towards, I don't want to call them conservative efforts, but sort of, let's call them backfilling efforts to interject into this vast, you know, media marketplace out there forms of what we call in academia peer review or some kind of editorial control. Are things on the internet, are things on wikis accurate information or not? This is, it seems to me, a huge, you know, a huge question. And one of the things that anyone in education now confronts is the fact that students generally are not trained critically to regard the information they get on the internet. So that, you know, someone claiming the moon is made of green cheese can get, you know, the same reaction from a student because it's all flattened out as information as NASA's scientists. So I suspect that what we're going to have to do as a society is figure out ways to, if not police, at least adjudicate the kinds of information that we get out there. And I guess, maybe this is my own utopian hope, is that what we'll see emerge are projects and editorial collectives which begin to rank for us, or rank in various ways, the elements that are available on the internet, so that we get a sense of, you know, the top 20 blog sites for, you know, conservative or liberal political views. That can be both bad and good, but I think that the notion that information out there is all equal is something that we're going to have to deal with.
It's definitely, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think I agree with you in part and disagree in part, and I guess I'll push back on it a little bit because, you know, clearly you're right that if you do a Google search, Google is ranking, its responses through an algorithm which is not public, but which looks at hits as much as, and I don't think really reflects accuracy. And that this was famously made clear, with Google bombing and the, you know, efforts to actually manipulate Google rank results by consistently hitting the same page over and over again so that Google sees it as a popular site. And in fact, that happened with a site called JewWatch, where at one point if you type Jew into Google, the first thing you got was a rabidly anti-Semitic website called JewWatch. But the larger question with that, and I guess is the part where I want to push back a little bit, is, aren't we, with the internet and the fact that the internet itself doesn't rank or reflect necessarily whether a particular entry or piece of information is accurate, isn't that a problem ultimately with the human beings using it and not with the technology? In other words, you know, before the internet, you had plenty of organizations and people saying wacky stuff. There's an organization which I recall as a kid called the Flat Earth Society that attempted to, you know, make the argument based upon Tycho Brahe's alchemy of eons ago that the Earth was flat, and I knew, of course, being a student in school, that the Earth was round. So I was able to look at that, you know, ridiculous claim and say it isn't valid. Now that may be an extreme example, but is it the technology that's at fault there? Is it the technology that's the problem, or is it ultimately a base question of education and the general judgment of that people might or might not have based upon their age or experience in using the technology?
Well, I think you've put your finger on it. I think that the assumption, the utopian assumption to go back to the 1980s, certainly in the beginning of the use of the term cyberspace and even the 1990s, is that technology somehow in and of itself would make us smarter. And I would agree with you. I don't think it's made us necessarily smarter or less smart, But I think what it has done is created a kind of need to, if not, I want to be very careful here. In terms of ranking of, you know, ranking of things, I mean, I think the Internet asks us to do this all the time in a rather casual sort of fashion. The example I would give is, you know, sports talk radio is now gone to the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
So that wherever you are in this country, you can get, you know, blogs with, you know, all sorts of people teeing off on, you know, sports teams and so on.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, however, and you're right, this stuff has always been going on, but now it seems to us more ubiquitous. It seems the normal kind of thing to do. As an educator, I think the one thing that you have to guard against is a kind of naive relativism
mm-hmm.
on the parts of students. Oh, well, it's just an opinion. Everybody's entitled to his or her own opinion, which is, in one sense, true, but on the other hand, the Flat Earth Society and scientists at NASA have different opinions, but one opinion I think most of us would agree is more valuable than the other.
Right.
And so I think that the Internet does, you know, both kinds of things. Some of the interesting projects that I'm aware of now, such as the Nines Project, it's housed at the University of Virginia, is a massive kind of undertaking to review critically all sorts of tools that are out there for the study of 19th century literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing, I think, is going to seep into the Internet at large. And it already does to some extent. I mean, if you go to, again, I'm not plugging anything, but if you go to MLB.com, you know, which, you know, you can watch every Major League Baseball telecast, which, talk about utopian as a baseball fan, mm-hmm. seems to me just absolutely wonderful, will rank things for you. Or Sports Illustrated in its baseball preview this year ranked the top three websites for each team as opposed to the top three pitching prospects. Well, that should tell you something,
right?
About how we're moving.
The in the remaining about 10 minutes that we have, I do want to touch on topics that, of course, in an hour-long conversation are difficult to discuss more than superficially. But let me read another sentence from your essay on page 71. You said, put simply, alienation projected onto already existing languages and identities is the enabling condition of cyberspace as a philosophical and ideological construct. Now, again, this is a book, the volume Virtual Realities and Our Discontents, which came out in 1996, and which, as you mentioned, is based upon writing that you did in 1994 and 1995. Again, you know, the questions I'm asking today really are ones of looking back and seeing how things have changed. Obviously, as we discussed at the beginning, virtual reality meant something very different in 1996 than it means today. And when you say virtual reality today, people often think of Second Life and There. Does the advent of massive virtual worlds like Second Life and There change your analysis? In other words, does the quality of the interaction that exists on the Internet change the way that you would construct alienation as you viewed it in 1996?
Well, I think that alienation is a kind of blanket term. I mean, it's obviously a term that Marx used to describe responses to industrialization 150 years ago. And I think that, you know, it had a certain currency in the 1950s and 60s when everybody supposedly felt alienated. I think what I mean by that in 1996 is somewhat different from what we're talking about today, but I'd come back to the question of why people or why people are fascinated by Second Life. And it seems to me that one of the things that technology does is always present us with ways that make us feel as though if we don't participate in it, if we don't have it, we're somehow inadequate or maybe less radically out of step. And I think this is the way in which, you know, we're basically sold things. And this is not necessarily to say this is bad or a moral evil or anything else. But, you know, if you go to, buy a car, there's obviously, and you recognize this, right, a complex symbolization going on in terms of what cars mean and what values they have and what kind of ways in which a particular car is functioning for you. So if I go out and shop for a Prius, it says something about me. It says about something that I need in terms of my self-image and my sense of social responsibility. If I go out, on the other hand, and buy a Hummer, that's a very different kind of symbolization that I think we all recognize. So I think that one of the questions that I would ask in terms of participation in this vast array of options in Internet culture is what kind of needs are being served. And I think the needs that are being served in some respects still can fall under the umbrella term alienation, that we need to feel as though we need to be made to feel, I suppose, that without these technologies, we're behind the curve in one way, shape, or form. And, of course, you know, technologies always, you know, work on the assumption, which is not always true, that new is better, that we're making improvements, that we're constantly forging ahead. And so traditional technologies, although they may have a nostalgia value, aren't as good, aren't as adequate, aren't as fulfilling ultimately.
It gets back to kind of what I think was a core point of the book, which is to look at technology reflecting human behaviors and emotions that predecess the technology itself, so that the, you know, ultimately it's setting up a construct that makes the argument, and I think it's certainly an argument that's worthy, whether or not one agrees with it, that the technology's doing mostly is reflecting the human condition generally. And in a similar sense, although not identical, the concept of code being law that Larry Lessig and others have written about is very true, that human beings ultimately are the ones writing the programs, writing the applications that create the internet, and in that way that controls what you can do and can't do, and both it reflects both the law, but it also reflects the human condition. So if we want technology that can do a certain thing and we have the capability of creating it, we do, and if we don't want technology that can do something or not, we don't write that technology. And I guess it leads to, in the last few minutes that we have, the overarching question, which is, you know, another unfair question that I ask of guests often, which is the crystal ball. As you look at where we are today versus where we were in the mid-90s, and now I'm going to ask you to jump ahead a few years. Now, you know, I agree with you 110% that a lot of the technologies like Second Life and we wouldn't have predicted, maybe 5 years ago, much less a number of people that are using Second Life. And really, in that way, Second Life does have meaning because people are leading lives in it and assuming alternate identities and what have you. But I ask you, from your view of the history of technology, as well as your writing in 1996, what do you think you'll be agreeing with that we've discussed today, and what do you think you might have to revise a little bit, say 3 or 4 years from now?
Well, now that is an unfair question.
Yes.
my guess is that technology...
I'll throw in an answer myself if it makes you feel better on that one.
Okay. I was going to say that, you know, my guess is that where technology is going to move is into all sorts of mobile devices, that is what we conventionally think of as robots. And I've got a feeling that the idea of these kind of motionless devices that we carry around with us are, if not, they're not going to be replaced, but they're certainly going to be supplemented by seeing increasingly, quote-unquote, intelligent things that move around the house and that do forms of labor for us, which are going to be quite interesting. I mean, this is something that we've been thinking about, certainly in terms of science fiction, for a long, long time. So I would guess that if we have this conversation or another like it in 4 or 5 years, our sense of what the Internet is will have begun to shift. I think it might be 10 or 15 years before it does, where the Internet is again, not a laptop you carry around, but what you're, you know, the next few generations of robots that are cleaning your, you know, condo are thinking about or are doing. And so, you know, you may, you know, now many people have the, you know, the robot vacuum cleaners, which kind of sweep up and bump into walls and, you know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that, you know, within the relatively near future, that robot will be able to tell you what the temperature is outside and, you know, tell you that you're running low on milk or something of that nature. I think that will get us a little closer to the notion of ubiquitous computing, of computing surrounding us and being much more integrated in our environment than it even is to this at this time.
And I think I would add to that, what I think also is going to be a topic of serious discussion is what we call today wearable computing, that the ability of human beings to simply wear devices that change how they view reality. And it's the kind of stuff that we saw in science fiction movies over the last several decades, of people wearing glasses that point out different things and what have you. And that's clearly something that's on the way, where whether we like it or not, we're going to have that stuff. I guess my last question for you is gets us back to the original point, which is, as we're here today using very old technology, because I'm talking to you by telephone and I'm sitting in front of an analog board, an engineering board that was built in the 1980s, and the technology hasn't changed so radically that it isn't useful today. I guess the question boils down to the way that human beings communicate today, and the way that they might communicate in the future. Does it ultimately lead you in the same direction of saying, well, we need to rethink what it is that we do with technology, and how do you think communication itself will look 3 or 4 years from now?
Again, another excellent question. I think that the topic we haven't dealt with, but I think is relevant to that question, is the problem of time. It's one thing to have information available, and it's one thing to be able to communicate information, but I think that you and I and everyone else needs time to read, to digest information. And so, in many ways, having libraries, thousands and millions of volumes at your fingertips on the Internet is a remarkable achievement, a remarkable engineering achievement that I don't think anyone except a science fiction writer could have predicted. But the question that we don't deal with is the question of, very well, I think, is the question of time. And so the question of communication to me is always bound up with the question of time, and time I mean labor as well. There is a dystopian view of you know, technological advances, and which is now, it's not so much that you can carry your office with you, but your work follows you around. I mean, imagine
right.
This idea in the 1950s that, Leave It to Beaver's dad would come home and, you know, we'd be pursued by information from the office. I guess he was a hardware salesman. Pursued by, you know, inventories of hammers and screws.
Right.
And I think that that's a crucial question that we're still grappling with as a society, which is the fact that all these technologies are in many ways labor-creating as well as labor-saving devices. And the example I always use in the classroom is, when I started teaching, we didn't have specialists in the university I was teaching in running around troubleshooting the chalk, you know, and telling us that, you know, there was pink chalk 2.0, and he was going to confiscate all the, you know, pink chalk 1.0 so we'd get new models. And I think in that way, we're still in many ways grappling with the relationship among communication, our identity as human beings, and time. And ubiquitous information, ubiquitous communication is not always a good thing. It's been very pleasant for the last hour, but not always a good thing. As I think we know when we encounter it in terms of having to, you know, work at our home offices till 1 or 2 in the morning.
I think, and on that note, because this is such a fluid conversation, I will certainly invite you back maybe sometime in the fall or next spring to continue the conversation, because, as you just said so eloquently, I think we're again just continuing to see massive changes in technology that could change both of our perspectives in a relatively short amount of time. So, Bob Margley from University of Illinois, I want to thank you for being on today, discussing your book, which, like I said in the introduction, introduction, although published in 1996 still has a lot of relevance today, Virtual Realities and Our Discontents. Thank you for being here today and for joining me on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
I want to thank Bob Markley from the University of Illinois being on today. And I ask questions that, like I said, were difficult because we're talking about a book that was came out 11 years ago and taking a look back and a look forward. But I enjoyed the conversation, as I hope you did. As always, you can find the show not only on KZSU but by going to hearsayculture.com for the podcast, as well as the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society, and also by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I also ask you to offer any comments, questions, criticisms, suggestions by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I want to thank you again for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to talking to you next week.